principle to take part in peace talks with his opponents. The Syrian opposition group still haven't committed to attend, in part because they insist that Assad must step down as part of any peace deal. Russia's deputy foreign minister, Sergei Rybkov, scolded the United States, saying it needs to put more pressure on the opposition groups and not allow them to impose preconditions on the talks. Diplomats are hoping the conference can be held sometime this month, but so far no date has been set. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
Ford is recalling more than 450,000 cars and SUVs because of fuel tanks that could possibly leak and cause fires. The recall affects model year 2013 Ford Fusions, Explorers, Tauruses, and Flexes, and Lincoln SUVs. The company says no fires or crashes related to the problem have been reported so far. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Lincoln Financial Group. For over 100 years, working to help Americans take charge of their futures and become their own chief life officers.
Join WILL this September and October on our Civil War train. We'll travel to Washington, D.C. and Williamsburg in private restored train cars from the 1950s. Along the way, we'll enjoy sightseeing in Gettysburg and Virginia, and we'll explore the historic sites, museums, and battlefields of the Civil War. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or go online to will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
And well, welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. And before I introduce my guest, I invite you to go over to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus and look for the page on today's Focus program, Seeing is Believing. You'll find a video for a short, what's called a selective attention test, very short. And if you want to go ahead, just go ahead, take the test, and see how you do. And we'll be talking about that a little bit later on the program with our guest. Dan Simons is featured in an episode of the TV science show Brain Games, which will be airing three times today on the National Geographic Channel. That episode premiered last week, but you can see it today during the day, Monday, 4 p.m., 8:30 p.m., and 11:30 p.m. Central Time. And it may show up again in future weeks, since the Nat Geo Channel likes to marathon the Brain Game show with frequent repeats. Dan Simons is with us in the studio today to talk about appearing on Brain Games and about the brain science he demonstrated. Dan is a professor at the University of Illinois in the psychology department and also in the Beckman Institute. He's the co-author from a few years ago with Christopher Chabris of the book The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us. That's published by Crown. The book has done very well. And Dan Simons appeared on Focus back in 2010 to talk about it. He's back with us today to continue the discussion of how we perceive things and sometimes fail to perceive things. Professor Simon, welcome to Focus.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
And separate from the test that we're asking people to try out on the Focus website at will.illinois.edu/focus. I went over to the Nat Geo TV website and saw a clip from the Brain Games program, and it showed you working with some basketball players trying to shoot baskets while wearing special goggles that shifted the position of what they saw 30 degrees to the right, which I gather is very disorienting. What did you want to demonstrate with that?
Well, it was a really fun demonstration to do. So what we were interested in was a process known as prism adaptation. So how your visual system adapts to that distortion, to having your world shifted off to the right by 30 degrees. And what's remarkable is how well our visual system can adapt to changes like that. So what we did, we had a group of basketball players from a New York City league who were really good shooters. We had them come onto the court and shoot free throws, and I think one of the guys made 9 out of 10. Another guy made about 8 three-pointers in a row. Really good shooters. We then had them put on these prism goggles, which shift their vision, shift basically the light from the world by about 30 degrees to the right. And as soon as they put them on, we have them stand at the free throw line and shoot a free throw. And what you find is that people miss the entire backboard. They shift. When they shoot, they feel like the world is right in front of them. They feel like what they're looking at is the basket, but what they're actually looking at is 30 degrees to the right of the basket. So when they shoot, they miss by 30 degrees in the opposite direction. What's remarkable about this is how quickly people can adapt to this distortion. So after shooting baskets for maybe 5 minutes, they start making them again. And our visual system, by taking that action, by performing this action as your visual system is giving you information, you align them. You align your actions to what the visual world is actually telling you, which is that things are off to the right.
Now, I'm wondering, this little experiment that you showed on the Brain Game show, is that something that came out of your research or somebody else's research? And what sort of question were you asking to start with?
Well, it's actually research. It's not my own research. It's research that's now over 50 years old, dating back to the middle of the 20th century. And the research was asking exactly that question. How does our visual system adapt to change, adapt to different information? And we experience this sort of adaptation all the time. We just don't realize it's happening. So, for example, if you rent a U-Haul to move, you get into that truck and it's much bigger than most cars, but you have no trouble adjusting to the difference in size. You don't run into the back of cars in front of you. You don't have trouble figuring out how much you have to press the brake to stop and how far in advance you have to stop. It all kind of adapts automatically. It might take a couple of minutes, but once you've adjusted, everything comes along for the ride. The PRISM adaptation studies in the middle of the century were designed to look at that process. How quickly can we adapt? How long does it take our visual system to adjust? One interesting thing is you have to act, right? You can't just put them on and then have the adaptation happen by default. You actually have to interact with the world so that you can allow your brain to calibrate the distortion to your actions.
You know, I'm thinking of something that happened to me, and I guess this would have been an example of failure of the experiment, although it's not something as clear-cut as that. Several years ago, when I had a car that had broken down, I was going to, at one point, buy somebody's beat-up old, I think it was a Dodge Horizon, with manual transmission, which I had little familiarity with. And we eventually just gave up on the idea because every time I tried to shift gears in the car, the engine died. And certainly the owner of the car had no trouble with it. I think it was a matter of figuring out how to the word that came up to me was finesse the controls. And I just didn't have enough time. And since I wasn't very familiar with manual transmission anyway, really, especially in that case, enough time to really get used to it. If I had had another day and a half, maybe, I would have gotten used to an old, beat-up, finicky Dodge Horizon with manual transmission. But in that case, I couldn't.
Yeah, and that's a slightly different sort of adaptation, right? That's how you learn a new procedure, a new process. And if you think back to when you first learned to drive, right, you had to think about how hard do I press the accelerator while you watch the speedometer to see how much your speed increases. And now, if you've driven for a few years or even really a few weeks, you no longer have to think about how much pressure you're applying with your foot. That becomes automatic. So the same thing when you're learning to drive a different vehicle with manual transmission, right? You have to learn those subtle differences that make the shift work effectively. But once you do that, once you practice it enough, you don't have to think about it anymore. This sort of adaptation we're talking about with these prisms is a little different in that it's really changing the information you're getting in the first place. And it's a way of kind of doing that systematically. So when you could put people in a different car, but it's hard to study how different it is from what you're used to. With the prism, you know exactly how different it is, and you can look at how the brain adapts.
And I guess there might be, I'm trying to think of cases where this happens with people, in some cases where perhaps where vision gradually deteriorates, but people figure out ways to compensate, making the most of the information they're able to get.
Yeah, absolutely. So with macular degeneration, for example, that's when the area of highest resolution of your eye deteriorates. The cones in your eye that are receptive, that give you a lot of detailed information, those are basically dying. And if you have macular degeneration, which is one of the more common visual diseases with age, you can only read using the periphery, which means that everything has to be really big because you don't have good resolution in your periphery. And you can adjust to that, but there's limits to how much you can adjust to that. You just don't have the information in that case. Whereas in the case of prisms, for example, shifting your vision, you have the information. It's just in the wrong place. And it's much easier to adjust to the same information in a different place than it is to adapt to missing information.
I have read or heard of instances where people who had been effectively blind had, through some sort of surgery, sight restored, sight that they had never really experienced before, mm-hmm. and they had to go through their own adjustment process of how to take in and interpret this new visual information.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really interesting problem. There aren't that many cases of people who were blind from birth due to cataracts or problems with their lens or other sorts of issues and then had their vision restored completely. But there are cases in which people, for example, had vision deficits that came in after they were 2 or 3 or 4, and then they have them fixed when they're adults. That early experience does help a lot in adjusting. But if you think about it, you're basically asking your brain to use information that it's never used. And if your brain has not had that information, those brain areas that are receptive to visual information often get repurposed for other things. So the process of learning to use visual information can be a real problem for people who have lost vision entirely. And it's actually a really interesting area of study from a theoretical perspective. How much visual information do you need in order to learn how to see?
Well, this almost dovetails with the experiment we're about to go back to. And this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with U of I psychology professor Dan Simons about what your eyes see but your brain may fail to take in. Simons is co-author of The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intentions Deceive Us, and his science is featured on a new episode of Brain Games on the National Geographic Channel. That's running today, Monday. And you can see that at 4 p.m., 8:30 p.m., and 11:30 p.m. Central Time. Give us a call if you have comments or questions for Professor Simons at 333-9455. The toll-free number, if you're out of town, is 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone number again is 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Or you can send us email again at will-talk@illinois.edu. You were talking a minute. We were talking about people who had sight restored and who had essentially had to call back parts of their brain which had gotten out of the habit of taking in that information. And I want to go back to the selective attention test that we've linked to on our website at will.illinois.edu. And some of our listeners may already be familiar with this idea. But it's a short video that you put together in 1999 originally, and it shows six people tossing basketballs to each other. People in three wearing black, three wearing white. You instruct people to watch carefully the ones wearing white and to see how many times the ones wearing white tossed the basketball around. But while that's going on, and people are counting that, what you're saying in the research that's been done, a whole lot of people don't notice something else that's going on at the same time. And what is that?
Well, in that particular version of the video, it's a person wearing a full gorilla suit who walks into the middle of the video, turns at the center and faces the camera, thumps his chest, and then walks off the other side. And it's on the screen for about 9 seconds. And for people who don't know about this in advance, when they're really intently focused on counting the passes by the players wearing white, about half of them don't notice the person in the gorilla suit. And what's interesting to me is not just that people miss this. That's actually something that we've known in cognitive psychology for many, many years. These studies were based on studies done in the late 1970s by Ulrich Neisser, one of my mentors, who found similar sorts of missing of things that were fairly obvious. What's interesting to me and the purpose that we of our doing the study was that people have the wrong intuitions about what they will and won't notice.
And perhaps we should define the term intuitions here. When we're saying intuitions, what do you mean specifically?
So I mean specifically beliefs about how our own minds work. Right. So I'm not talking about sort of religious experiences or aha sort of intuitions. I'm talking about our beliefs about our own minds. And we tend to assume that we understand who better can know us than we know ourselves, right? We tend to assume that we know ourselves, our attitudes, our beliefs, how our minds work. But in reality, what we know is our experiences, and our experiences are incomplete. So the end result is that we think we know why we see what we do. We think we know what we'll notice. We think that something important in our environment will grab our attention, but that intuition is wrong. We have mistaken intuitions because our experiences mislead us. So in the case of this person walking through the scene, most people are convinced just hearing about this video that, of course, I would notice the gorilla. Of course, everybody would notice it. It's really obvious. When you show it to them again after they've missed it, it's like, how could I have possibly missed that? And it's that experience, this mistaken belief that, of course, I should have seen that, that is really, for me, the more interesting phenomenon. We think we're going to notice these things, because if you look back at your past experiences, you're only aware of those things in the world that you've noticed. You're not aware of all the stuff you might have missed. So imagine you watch that video. You count the passes by the players wearing white. You do a good job doing that. You miss the gorilla. And then I never ask you about having seen a gorilla. In that case, you'd continue to go through life believing that, of course, you would have spotted the gorilla if you're told about it. We don't have that experience of becoming aware of the things we've missed. So the end result is we're only aware of those things we notice, and then we think we notice everything.
That does raise a question, because here's a particular visual experience. A group of people look at it, and about half of them see something different than the other half. And if you look at something like, say, let's say a crime scene, or say something that happens on the street where it's important to have a good memory of what happened, you'll have people with different ideas of what they saw, even when they're all looking at the same thing.
That's exactly right. So to a large extent, what we see is what we expect to see. And if you think about how vision works, our attention is really limited. We're only aware of a tiny subset of our world at any moment. And what that means is that different people can be aware of different subsets of the possible information in the world. We describe an example, an anecdote in our book, of a case in which two people driving a car witness a stabbing. Right? So they witness a crime right in front of them on the sidewalk. And after they get through the red light, they call 911. And one of the people in the car starts reporting what they'd seen. And the other person contradicts them and said, no, he wasn't wearing jeans. He was wearing sweatpants. And no, he was Hispanic, not white. And they have these contradictory beliefs about something they saw a moment ago. And that's entirely plausible in the sense that our memories are not always a perfect photographic record of what we've seen. They're kind of constructed along the way.
Now, in a case like that, do we know that do memories fade with time, even a quick appearance of time? If you talked, say, to two people 30 seconds after the event and then 3 minutes after the event and an hour or a day after the event, would you have a greater divergence in the details?
Most likely, yeah. And each time you have people recall it, they can have a divergence of details. If you give them misleading information, they can have a divergence of details.
So unless they've like written down everything immediately, so they have something locked in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Probably all of you have experienced this. You're in a meeting and you come to an agreement about what strategy to take, for example, and then 2 weeks later, you have an argument about what was agreed to in that meeting. Right? And you completely remember what happened, and the other person completely remembers what happened, and you remember different things. So one of the things that you can do to deal with that is exactly as you suggested, write it down. So we actually, a practical recommendation is if you're in a meeting and there's a possibility that people are going to come away from it with different impressions, the best thing you can do is write out what you agreed to, email it to everybody and have them agree to the email or to correct it if it's wrong. That highlights any differences and also forces people to commit to an interpretation of what had happened so that 2 weeks later, if they remember it differently, they can look back at their notes and say, oh, okay, I guess I'm wrong.
This goes on to something I noticed in one of the chapters of The Invisible Gorilla, which, of course, we now know is named after that gorilla that half the people in a viewing group do not see, something that you call the illusion of knowledge. And the example you give is inviting the reader to draw a bicycle. Mm-hmm. And essentially the problems that come up are remembering what the mechanics of a bicycle are, where that chain down there goes, mm-hmm. and what it connects. And this is, you know, people are, I think what you were saying, essentially, you and your co-author were saying that people assume they know this stuff. But when it comes down to the details, maybe not.
Yeah, that was a great study done by Rebecca Lawson some years ago. And it's a really simple task. I mean, if you think you know how a bicycle works, maybe you ride your bike to work every day. Just take a second and try and sketch it out. It doesn't have to be a really fancy drawing.
From memory.
Yeah, from memory. Don't look at a bike. Everybody can sketch a bike looking at it, maybe some better than others. But try and sketch out from memory how the different parts of a bike work. So make sure to put the pedals on, the handlebars, the chain, the wheels, where do they all go? And we all know the parts of a bike. And you might ride one every day. But even people who ride them every day make mistakes in that drawing that would make a bicycle that couldn't possibly work. So the most common mistake, and try and think about it in your mind for a moment, see if you can kind of come up with how it would all hold together. Where would the chain connect? Where would the pedals be? Some people did things like drawing the pedals outside of the chain. And if you think about that, what are they turning then? Right. Some people do things like connecting the wheel rigidly to the frame. Right. Then how would it turn the front wheel? Some people draw the chain connecting the front and the back tires, front and the back wheel. And if you think about that, a chain is a rigid object. Right. So if the chain is connecting the two wheels, the bike could only go straight. It couldn't possibly turn because how would the front wheel turn? What's interesting about this case is not that we can't draw a bicycle very well. It's that we think we can. So we believe that we have much deeper knowledge than we actually do. Go ahead.
I'm going to break in just so we can take a caller. And this is line one, Mike in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about an anecdote that, and I don't remember this very well, but this is not designed to be a test of my memory of this. I'll just try to describe this story or anecdote I heard in relation to some conversation about these issues, I think on talk radio, maybe on WILL. The story goes that in the last age of exploration, or whatever you call that, in, let's say, the 14, 1500s and somewhere in there, when a sailing ship pulled up in this harbor in some small island, and the natives were on the shore, so I'm not going to get this very well, but maybe this is going to trigger something in your mind. Maybe you know this. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a classic anecdote. I don't know. Natives were observing the ship, but they didn't see it because they had no frame of reference to interpret it. That's not a very good explanation, mm-hmm. but do you know anything about this concept and how they would prove that, for that matter? I mean, how do they know they didn't see it?
But. Yeah. I mean, it's a famous story, and it might be apocryphal. I've always heard it told as Columbus arriving and having the Native Americans not recognize what they were seeing. It's not clear whether that's true or not, and it's hard to see how you would test it now.
Right. I suppose waiting for the first arrival from a civilization from another planet, would we recognize their vehicle or the beings themselves as being a vehicle or beings?
Right. Would we even see them? I mean, that's kind of – if you can just discuss that a little, I just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
It's a really interesting question, is how do we see things that we don't expect to see, right? And one of the interesting findings here is that if it's unexpected and we're focused on something else, then we often will miss the unexpected thing. That's the lesson of the gorilla video, but many, many other examples like that. Here's another example that is similar in some ways. Richard Haynes, back in the early 1980s, did the study in a high-grade flight simulator at NASA Ames Research Center. And he had commercial airline pilots flying in the simulator and using a head-up display that projected their altitude and their airspeed and other flight information onto their windshield. And the idea is that you don't have to look away from where you're going in order to kind of keep seeing the environment. And he had them flying many, many loops. They'd take off, they'd land. And on one of the landings, they broke through the cloud cover in a slightly foggy conditions. And as they're coming in for the landing, there's another jet sitting on the runway. So what's known as a runway incursion. There was a plane that was sitting on the runway that wasn't supposed to be there. And what you found was that a couple of the pilots landed right through it. They never saw it. And many of the pilots pulled up much too late. The idea here is that what's happening is that they're not expecting a plane to be on the runway. There shouldn't be a plane on the runway. And they're focusing attention on the display rather than on the external world. And the result is that they simply don't see something that shouldn't be there in the first place. It turns out that runway incursions are the most common kind of airplane accident, and actually the worst aviation accident of all time was exactly that sort of a case. A 747 was on the runway right as another 747 was taking off.
So it's a matter of something that is unexpected, but also the pilots were distracted by that information right in front of their, in their foreground plane of view.
So they're focused on something else. It's a little different than the situation you describe in which something that we've never seen or encountered before happens as we're just looking at it.
But the thing in common, and then if we go back to the experiment that we opened the show with, and that's the one with the basketball players and the gorilla, is that the people being, when you're being tested, you're concentrating on the basketball players. Mm-hmm. You're not expecting a gorilla.
Right.
If you were just watching it more passively, the gorilla might be in much more obvious plain sight for those who did not see the gorilla.
Absolutely. It is obvious, right? It's a gorilla, a person in a gorilla suit thumping its chest at the camera. It's really obvious, but you don't see it because you're focusing attention on something else.
Now, is it I thought I read this. There's been versions of this test where people's eye movements have been tracked.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. The eyes seem to have focused on the gorilla at some point.
Yeah. So there have been a couple of people who have done this. Daniel Memmert in Germany and Vanessa Beal in Australia have both done this, where they monitor people's eye movements using a device known as an eye tracker. So it's a device that you can wear that basically records exactly where on a scene or on a display you're looking in real time. And what they find in both cases was that people who missed the gorilla were no less likely to look at it. They were just as likely to look at it as people who saw it, and they typically looked at it for about a second on average and just didn't see it.
That should be long enough to recognize a gorilla being there.
Right. In fact, if you flash a photograph of a scene really briefly, you can tell what kind of scene it is if you flash it for only 20 to 30 milliseconds. So we're really good at recognizing things just by looking at them, but just because you look at something doesn't mean that you see it.
So with a combination of distraction, why, because you're focusing on something else, and because it is unexpected, we have a situation where a person will see the gorilla, but their brain just won't take it in.
Well, there's a really interesting question there. What does it mean to see the gorilla? So certainly the light that bounces off that gorilla, or if it's a display that comes to your eyes from that gorilla, it's hitting your eyes, your photoreceptors are responding to it, probably some part of your brain is responding to it, but it doesn't reach awareness, right? It's not the sort of thing that we can consciously report. And to a large extent, that's what matters, right? What you can report on is what you can act on. If you're able to see it, if you consciously see it, that's what it requires to act on it.
And then the connection that Mike brought in his example, mm-hmm. of saying people who don't have much in the way of sailing technology, who may just have boats with oars, would just not know what to take of a European sailing vessel.
It's possible. But you can also think about this in the way that visual expertise works for all of us. So it'd be hard to study something that's completely out of our realm of normal experience. But you can certainly look at things with different levels of expertise. So an architect, for example, or a contractor will look at a house and see things that you or I might not. They'll see subtleties of the design, subtleties of the structure that you or I wouldn't see because we just don't have that knowledge. We would still see the house, but we might not see those subtleties that you learn to see with a lot of practice and a lot of experience. So there's a sense in which we're always missing things in our environment that are falling outside of what we know to look for and know how to look for.
Well, it's time for a short break. We will be back in a moment with more on the brain, intuitions, and perception with Dan Simons. This is Focus on WYLL.
On the next Fresh Air, Alicia Abbott tells us about being the child of a gay father in San Francisco at the dawn of the gay liberation era. There were few gay parents then, and she says gay men found children unsettling.
My presence was reminding people of a world of traditional family structure and responsibility that some people were trying to escape from.
Abbott's memoir is Fairyland. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILO programming is made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, announcing the 2013-2014 season featuring El Nora, the Guitar Festival, Hungarian State Folk Ensemble Gypsy Romance, Meredith Monk on Behalf of Nature, the Moscow Festival Ballet, and more. Tickets are on sale Saturday, August 10th at 10 a.m.
I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with University of Illinois psychology professor Dan Simons, talking about your brain, your intuition, your perception, and reality. They don't always match up. As Dan shows in an episode of Brain Games called Now You See It, it's on the Nat Geo cable channel. That episode premiered last week. It's being rerun today on the Nat Geo channel. The viewing times today, 4 p.m., 8:30 p.m., and 11:30 p.m. Central Time. You can call with your questions and comments at 333-9455. If you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And, Dan, we were just talking about the example of whether it was the pilots with the extra with the extra windshield information that distracted them from planes on their runway, to the people taking the basketball players and the gorilla experiment who didn't see the gorilla while they were focusing on the basketball player. It raises questions about the wisdom of multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it, you know, multitasking is good if you can do it, but it just suggests that we don't always do it that well.
In fact, almost nobody can actually do true multitasking well at all. And part of, I think, the problem is that people confuse what's actually multitasking from what all of us do all the time, which is juggling lots of tasks that we're doing. So everybody has lots of things that they're trying to keep track of, regardless of what your job is or what you're doing in your daily life. You're doing multiple things. You're thinking about what you're going to have for dinner. You're also thinking about what projects you have to accomplish that day, whether you have to walk the dog. All of those sorts of things are things that we have to do. They're tasks. But multitasking means doing two things at the same time that use the same resources. So chewing gum, talking, and whistling all use your mouth and the same resources in conflicting ways, and we can't do them all at the same time. Well, the same is true for our cognitive resources, for how our mind works. We have a limited pool of attention, and things that use attention in one way, you can't do two things that use the same attention resources in the same way and do each of them equally well.
Is it something that you can get better at with practice?
It's not clear. Some things just are structural limits, right? Some things you just can't do simultaneously. There's some things you can practice and become automated at doing, just as we were talking at the beginning of the program about driving and becoming automated in some of our abilities, like learning to drive. You learn how to press the accelerator exactly the right amount to speed up the amount you want to do. At first, you have to think about that. Later, you don't have to think about that. So things that don't have to use attention anymore. Sure, you can do those along with other things. I'm an experienced juggler. I can juggle and think of other things at the same time because it's something I've practiced. I don't have to think about it anymore. But for things that require attention in a fluid, constant sort of way, you can't do them if they conflict with other things that require attention in the same ways.
Now, are there some people who have a gift for doing that better than others?
There probably is a range of abilities, just like for any ability. There's a range of multitasking abilities. Some people are going to be less impaired than others. There are some suggestions that there are people who aren't as impaired, but it's new research. It's very limited in scope so far. Most of the evidence suggests that nobody really can do this well, although a lot of people think they can.
Okay. No hard evidence of multitasking savants out there.
Not yet compelling evidence that there are multitasking savants. The general message is that most of us can't multitask when you have two things that use the same resources. And here's the real problem. We don't realize, because we don't understand exactly how our minds work and those mechanisms of our mind, we don't realize when two things might be conflicting. Take, for example, driving and talking on a cell phone. Both of those require attention, but they seem really different. And as it turns out, the act of generating speech and understanding speech uses attention. It requires attention. It can't be automated in the way that we think it can. And so does driving and paying attention to unexpected things in our environment.
And doing it on the phone is different from, say, talking to a passenger in the car.
It appears to be for several interesting reasons. So one reason is it's just easier to hear a person sitting next to you. Another is that a person sitting next to you isn't doing the task of driving. So they're not using attention to do that, which means that they're more likely to spot something unexpected out in the world and warn you. And the third reason, I think, is the more interesting one, which has to do with the social context of talking to a passenger versus talking to somebody on another end of the phone. The passenger knows what's going on in the environment around them. So, and you as the driver know that they know. So if you run into traffic and you stop talking, you know that the passenger is going to look outside and realize that there's traffic and will realize why you stopped talking. The person on the other end of a phone conversation doesn't know the shared context. They don't know whether people out there, whether you've stopped talking because of the traffic or because
you're angry. They may not know you're in a car.
They may not know you're in a car. And if you stop talking suddenly, they may assume that it's something that they said as opposed to what's going on in the world. So most of the evidence to date that actually directly compares passengers in a car to passengers to talking to somebody over a phone suggests that the passenger in a car isn't nearly as distracting, although it probably is distracting to some extent, not as bad.
Well, let's go ahead and take another call. And yes, here we are, line one, Larry in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Here you're fine. Yep.
Okay, I took a psychology course in the late 60s, and there was a film we watched, and the man wore inversion goggles. So he had great difficulty walking around. Everything was flipped over. But after a few days of wearing these that shut everything out, blocked his peripheral vision, things flipped over in his mind, and it was normal again.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the most extreme form of prism adaptation. That's the sort of thing that I talked about with the basketball, people shooting baskets where it shifted their gaze 30 degrees to the left or right. That sort of adaptation is much faster and much easier. The basketball players, within about 5 minutes of shooting baskets, adapted. But for inverting the world, the evidence from the 1950s and 1960s, that video that you saw, shows that people can do it, but it's much, much more disruptive. It's much harder.
Right. And he went through a lot of anxiety and pain.
A lot of headaches.
Then he took the goggles off after a few days, and the world was inverted again.
Yep, exactly. And it takes a while to readapt. And that's actually what we found with the basketball players, too. When they took the goggles off, they missed their free throws to the opposite side of the basket. But very quickly, you adapt back to it.
And Larry, it sounds like from the class and the video that you saw back then, the guy wearing the inversion goggles, after a while then, it wasn't that he learned to translate the upside-down image. It's that everything appeared to be right side up in his brain again.
Yes. And then the last part, when he took them off and everything was inverted, he's had the same difficulty getting around, but things turned around again. This time it took longer. And they said that he went through such anguish and headaches and trauma that this was one of those cases where they said, don't try this at home. And so they thought it could be really damaging.
Yeah. I mean, the typical finding, as I understand it, is that the process of getting back to normal after you take the glasses off is a bit quicker, typically. But it's still uncomfortable. It still is headache-inducing. You can think of this in a more mild way. If you've learned a foreign language and then you go to that country, so when you first learn a foreign language, you're regularly translating from your native language to the foreign language. Right? So in your head, you're having to think, if I want to speak in French, I have to think, okay, how do I say I need to go to the restaurant or I need to go to a restroom? You have to translate it in your mind. But if you go to a country and are immersed in the language for some period of time, you start thinking in that language. And that's a sort of cognitive adaptation. You kind of get used to the process. What's going on in these sort of visual adaptation cases is the same sort of thing. It just requires actively doing it. So if you would wear those inversion goggles and just sit around on a couch and don't actually try and move, it would look awkward. You might get a headache, but you wouldn't ever really adapt to it. You wouldn't be able to act on the world as if it were normal. Same thing with the ones that shift your glasses, shift your view 30 degrees. If you just sat there and never shot a free throw, you wouldn't adapt. Your brain wouldn't adjust to the changed visual information. But by acting on it, your visual system recalibrates to the actions you're producing so that the actions produce the right outcome.
You put inversion glasses on and sit on a couch and you'll see the world upside down forever?
Yeah.
If you don't have to act on the data that you're getting, your brain isn't really working to get acclimated.
Yeah, you can think of it as a remapping. Basically, you're trying to remap your actions onto the visual information and feedback you're getting. And when you've got those inversion goggles or the shifting goggles on, your visual feedback is wrong, right, initially. So the action that normally would produce a great free throw produces a free throw that misses the backboard entirely. And it's only by getting that information and adjusting it that you start to perform accurately. This is something we do all the time. If you, for example, you're not wearing prism goggles, and you're throwing darts, for example, and you throw one too high. The next time, you'll try and adjust it and throw it a little lower. You adapt, and your visual system kind of gives you the right feedback as you're doing this. Your actions produce feedback and visual information, and you have to adjust them.
Well, this guy didn't – they didn't say that he learned how to walk adjusting. They said that at a certain point, everything became normal.
That's right, but it took several days.
His reality in his brain changed, and then when he did it the second time, it was something. They didn't try it a third time because...
Yeah. No, that's right. But had he just sat on the couch, he wouldn't have had that flip. He wouldn't have had
really?
It switch to feeling natural.
Sitting there for several weeks, he wouldn't...
If he didn't move, no.
He didn't move?
Right.
If he didn't have to look on... What you're saying is that if he didn't have to look at anything and then act on what he
that's
saw...
That's right. He'd never... Yeah. Okay. He'd know something was wrong in that case, but with because everything would be upside down and that's just unnatural. But, for example, if the prism goggles we had people wear shooting baskets just shifted things off 30 degrees to the right, from your perspective, you wouldn't really know anything was wrong unless you moved, right? Unless you tried to act, unless you tried to walk through a doorway and walked into the wall.
Now, did they get headaches? Did they have any kind of psychological problems with did they vomit?
No. With the shifting one, the reason we did the shifting things 30 degrees to the right is that's not nearly as difficult to deal with as inversion. Inversion is really uncomfortable because we never get anything like it. But shifting things off to the a little bit off to the side, we can have that happen if you just wear new glasses with a different prescription. It's a little more extreme than that. But no, they didn't really get any headaches. They were a little frustrated at how badly they were shooting because these were all great basketball players. But they didn't really get headaches or anything like that.
Okay. All right. Thank
yep.
you.
Larry, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Let's go ahead to another caller on line two, Gary in Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, good morning. It's a very interesting topic. My question relates to a lot of the findings that reporting seem to say that we have weaknesses in what we do. We don't see things that are there. We don't notice things that we don't expect to see. But you have to think about that we're a pretty successful species, and we've been, you know, managed to survive through all kinds of environments, from, you know, wild animals around to now having to worry about cars on freeways. And so it would seem that a lot of the things, couldn't you see that these sort of defects that you're looking at are actually not defects, but they're actually adaptations that are provide advantage to us to be able to, you know, function and to live in the world that we're used to live in and the world that we live in today?
Absolutely. That's actually a fantastic insight. And our book, we're talking about a lot of cases where our intuitions are wrong and where they can be misleading and dangerous. But our intuitions aren't really the important thing. And the fact that we miss things is actually a byproduct of something we have to do really well, which is to be able to focus attention and ignore distractions. So you wouldn't want to be able to notice everything in your environment, given the limits on our ability to pay attention. You wouldn't want to see everything. You would be constantly distracted away from the things you're trying to see. So focused attention is crucial to what we do, and we presumably evolved to be able to do that quite well, to focus on the task that we care about and ignore the distractions. And most of the times, there aren't people wearing gorilla suits walking around in front of us. Most of the time, there aren't unexpected events because we basically are building our visual system to detect the things we want to detect. Now, that said, the conditions under which our visual system evolved and which our species survived are quite different from those that we exist in now. Now we might be traveling at 60 miles an hour, and a brief delay in noticing something unexpected could be catastrophic, whereas in the time that our visual system evolved the ability to focus attention, it might not have mattered all that much. So just because we're adapted to deal with the way our visual system works well and the way – and sometimes that leads to mistaken intuitions, but the way we've evolved was maybe very effective at one time but might not always be effective now. And those mistaken intuitions are the real problem. The fact that we don't notice everything, well, that's always been true of us. But the fact that we think we do notice everything is the real problem.
Yeah, well, as a quick follow-up then, given the new environment in which we do live today, are there any changes that you would make if you could tinker inside the hardware and software of our brains that would say this would really help us get along a lot better in the modern world? Anything come to mind?
Well, there are a lot of things that would be ideal. So, for example, to the extent that it matters that we remember things precisely, it'd be great if we had something like photographic or record-like memory, but we don't. I think the most important thing, if we could change anything, and this is something I think we actually can change, is to try and adjust our intuitions so that they map onto the reality of what we see and what we remember. If you were building a system, there are some things you can build computers to do perfectly that we can't do. So you can build a computer system that can remember what it saw perfectly. Right? It can build a perfect model of the world that it experienced. We can't. But then again, we can recognize handwriting, and it's very difficult for computers to do that. And we can recognize speech. A two-year-old can recognize speech almost as well, if not better, than most computer systems. So there's some things we do great already. We just have some limits.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And let's go ahead. The calls are starting to come in a little thicker. Line 4, Diane in Tuscola. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. If this is off topic, I apologize, but I wonder if with people with sensory issues, example, someone with an Asperger's diagnosis, could you address that?
Sure. So there have been some claims, for example, that people on the autism spectrum would be more likely to notice unexpected things. And
this is sort of the Rain Man scenario in the movie.
Yeah,
the guy who was able to count the cards very well.
Yeah, and I think really it's less likely that there's a massive difference in the capacity of attention, and it's more a difference in how people focus on things that they're interested in. There actually is relatively little difference that these basic cognitive abilities differ across people too much. There are big differences in what people are interested in. There are big differences in how they respond to overwhelming sensory information, for example. But the limits on how much we can focus attention on and how much we can remember and how precisely, sure, there are some exceptional cases, but most people, it's really just a difference in what interests them and what they tend to focus attention on that leads to what they're likely to notice. And that's true for people who aren't dealing with sensory deficits. So if you're a fashion designer, you're going to be more likely to pay attention to people's clothes, and you might be less likely to notice what they're carrying. And if you are an architect, you're going to notice details about a house that are different than what you would notice if you're a realtor. So it just differs in terms of how we focus attention as opposed to the capacity of attention.
May I ask something else?
Sure.
Any tips on helping someone with sensory issues to dial down after maybe a sensory overload?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's a bit outside of my area of expertise. For that, you'd really want to talk to an expert who deals with therapy for people who have sensory issues much more than I would know. I'm more focused on the basic attention processes that are common to almost all of us.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep, thank
Fascinating
you.
Program.
Thank you. And let me go ahead to another caller on line 1, Tony in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, I have two questions. I'll ask them and then ring off. One, I think I know the answer, but I want to double check. That is that women always make a big deal of men not knowing the color of their eyes. Do they have any reason to be worried when the man doesn't? And then, two, is it possible to train yourself to have a much more inclusive, observing ability? And I'll hang up and listen over the radio. Thanks.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you.
The first one, the man not noticing the color of your wife's eyes, that dovetails, I think, with the email that came in. Why can't I be looking right at something I am looking for and not see it? My wife can find almost anything, but I can't.
What's interesting is that they're so far in all of the studies we've looked at and how well people notice changes and how well people take in things like unexpected gorillas, we have not yet found any consistent sex differences. And most of the studies that look at multitasking abilities don't find sex differences either. There are big differences in what people find interesting and what they focus attention on.
Eye color.
Eye color.
I think yours are brown, Dan. But
greenish-brown,
Maybe I'm just not a very good observer in this case.
Yeah, so it partly depends on what people are interested in focusing on. And you'll notice those things that you focus attention on. So if you want to notice eye color, you'll pay attention to people's eyes much more, and you'll remark on it, you'll remember it, and that will lead you to noticing it more. There might be sex differences in how much people are likely to pay attention to people's eyes, but that I don't know. That'd be an interesting thing to study.
But as far as is it something that is trainable? That was that was Tony's second question. Can you get better at this sort of thing? And are there any particular things you should do in trying to be better?
It's a really interesting question. I would argue that the short answer is no, and probably that's a good thing. There's a sense in which we have limited attention capacity. You might be able to, with a lot of practice, improve your ability to pay attention in a particular kind of way to particular kinds of things. So you can get better at doing tasks over and over again. You get better at them. You can focus attention more efficiently. But can you broaden your attention so that you can take in everything? I think the short answer is no, and the important answer is that you wouldn't want to, because it would mean you couldn't focus on the things that you really care about and filter out distractions. If you don't bother focusing attention, you'll be more likely to notice unexpected things, but you'll also be less able to do what you want to do.
And that also comes up that if you really care about something, and if you start to really care about something you didn't really care about before, you will become more attentive to those things.
Yeah, absolutely. With practice, you get better and better at noticing details and being able to look at what's important and filter out the irrelevant stuff. You can think about this as an example of expertise, and it's something that you really want to be able to do. You want to be able to get better at the things that you care about while filtering out the irrelevant stuff. So, for example, a doctor who's just learning might not filter out the irrelevant diagnoses, those really rare diagnoses that are not likely to be the case. An expert knows not to bother thinking about if somebody comes into their office with a cough, they're not going to even consider the possibility that it's Ebola. Right, they're going to consider it to be a cold.
Well, here's an example, and we're getting into about the last minute of the program. But Mike emailed in a something that actually happened during the 2011-2012 Illinois basketball season, in which a men's game was played for the first half with a regulation women's basketball, which is smaller, and nobody noticed. And here we have experienced officials, players, coaches, and ball boys. This is the sort of thing they should have seen. It took them until halftime.
Yeah, it took them quite a while in to notice that something was wrong. Or the players, though, reported that their shots were off. So they noticed that something was wrong, but they didn't catch it right away. And actually, from what I remember of that particular case, the players were complaining to the coach, and the coaches were complaining, but it just didn't get fixed for a while because they didn't realize what was wrong. And I gather there are often complaints that are worth ignoring.
So it just took them a while to focus that, yes, this was a case.
And figure out exactly why it was wrong.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking today with University of Illinois psychology professor Dan Simons. And sure, don't your website, dansimons.com, where you can find out more about your research in this particular area.
And you can see a lot of these sorts of videos as well and examples of these sorts of things.
A little more of Dan Simons' work is on a recent episode of Brain Games that will be rerun today on the Nat Geo channel at 4 p.m., 8:30 p.m., and 11:30 p.m. Central Time. Dan's also the co-author with Christopher Chabris of The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Dan, thanks for coming back on Focus today.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me on.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show produced by Winsey Moon. Mike Pritchard is our technical director. Tomorrow, an earlier generation of parents worried about how much time their kids spent watching TV. Now the computer screen raises just as many questions, if not more. Chris Berube will be your host tomorrow, and his guest, Hannah Rosen, wrote about the child screen time debate for The Atlantic. That's coming up tomorrow on Focus. This is Focus on WILL.
Support for WILL Agriculture comes from Murray Wise Associates, LLC. Land auctions, farm management, financial services, and institutional and corporate real estate. Information on upcoming land auctions can be found at murraywiseassociates.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. A measure of U.S. manufacturing fell in May to its lowest level since June of 2009. The Institute for Supply Management today says that its index of manufacturing activity fell to 49 last month from 50.7 in April. That's the lowest level in nearly 4 years, and the first time the index has dipped below 50 since November. A reading under 50 indicates contraction. The manufacturing reading suggests that the economy will slow in the April-June quarter from its 2.5% annual pace. In the first 3 months of the year, many analysts expect the economy's annual growth rate this quarter to be about 2%. Let's go ahead and look and see how the futures are trading in Kansas City. July wheat at 744 is down 7. July wheat in Chicago, 699 and 3 quarters, down 5 and 3 quarters. July corn, 647, down 15. December, 555 and a half, down 11 and 3 quarters. Go out to May of 14 at 570 and a quarter, now a half, down 12 and a quarter. July soybeans, 1528 now 28.25, up 18.25. November, 13.17.5, up 13.25. July soybean meal, 452.20, up $5, now 520. July soybean oil, 48.43, up a nickel. June live cattle, 120.42.5, down 87.5. And June feeders, August feeders rather, 144.15, down 17.5. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.